Podcast.
This is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. This month, we start with a look at the pin-sharp detail of Pieter Sanradam's interior of the Boerkerk at Utrecht. The mid-17th century work depicts, with great accuracy, a lofty church interior flooded with natural light. The vaulting architecture captures all the peace and tranquility of the sacred space, but beneath there's a far more secular scene. A dog and two small children, one busy drawing graffiti on the church wall. We asked curator Betsy Wiesman and Professor Erica Fudge, an expert in the representation of animals, what this tension tells us about life in the 17th century. Betsy began by describing the work.
What I find so interesting is that a lot of the detail and the action is focused at the bottom quarter of the painting. And if you just visually scan down from the top of the painting to the bottom, at the top you have this almost ethereal arrangement of very pure lines of the arched ceiling of the church, and then you slowly move down and the network of arches becomes a little more complex, and then you get this flood of light from the windows, and then you move down the walls of the church, and then you have this patterned floor and the figures, and suddenly it becomes a lot more active with a lot more visual interest and just a buzz of human activity.
But I think what's most interesting, of course, are the two children, one of whom looks like they are graffitiing the walls of the church, which is fantastic, which is, of course, what children might do, and the other one sitting down with a well-trained dog. And I think on one level, children in churches might draw on walls. They may still draw on walls these days. But I think what's really interesting is that that fits with this idea of the light, the ethereal height, that at the base of humanity we are bodies, and children and dogs in this period become really clear representations of the fearful fleshiness of humanity, that children must learn not to be children, to be adults, to be reasonable, to be rational. And I suppose this is the distinction between the child who appears to be drawing on the wall and the adults with a young person with them who are reading what is on the wall and meant to be on the wall. So there's that nice distinction between the good child and the naughty child. And I think it's worth saying that the base of the painting, while it brings in colour and darkness, it's also, of course, an image of gravestones. So what we know is beneath the painting, outside of the frame of the painting, or below the frame of the painting, are dead bodies, are the kind of very fleshy remains of humans. That is all we are. And there they are, sort of just beyond the picture.
One detail that I particularly liked was the juxtaposition right above the children's heads of Moses with the Ten Commandments, shown with the tablets. And he's this very fierce-looking figure. But it does support that idea of through law, through reason, and, you know, conforming to certain standards of behavior, of civility, whatever, that you can be raised.
I mean, one of the things that's happening in Protestant culture, in England as well as in the Netherlands, is what Norbert Elias called, the historian Norbert Elias said, was a shifting kind of boundary of embarrassment. And so what we would see as normal behaviour, not blowing your nose on a tablecloth, is actually being constructed in the 16th century. And there's some fantastic manuals that Norbert Elias pulled out. And, you know, people told not to pee in corridors, not to pee in the dining room during a meal. And it's stuff that we just read and think, you're joking. And so I think dogs, again, are symbolically attached to this, because a dog will pee anywhere. And in another one of these genre paintings, there are dogs peeing in churches. And I think this just reinforces the sense that how that child becomes human is not simply putting down the crayon and stop drawing on the wall. It's learning to control his body. And urination becomes, you know, a very simple part of that. And of course it still is. You know, you have to teach a child to use, you know, to potty train a child. And so at the bottom of this, we have, with this great picture of these two children and the dog, a sort of midpoint. There's a child who's being childish, drawing on a church wall. This is very bad. Drawing a picture of a very secular story and so on. We've also got a child training a dog. It's on the way to control. So the picture is hopeful. It's sort of making sure we know humans are fleshy, but also making sure we know that there is light. And there is the kind of the height of eternal possibility if we you know, are able to take it. Of course, it's God's will that we will be able to take it in Protestant thought. You know, control yourself and it will all be all right. Don't act like a dog.
Betsy Wiesman and Erica Fudge talking about Sanredam's Interior of the Boerkerk at Utrecht. If you'd like to see the painting for yourself, it's on display in room 16. Next, the gallery's collection includes many works produced by artists who, when judged by the standards of today's youth-obsessed culture, might be considered past their prime. Among these pictures are an astonishing group painted by the French impressionist Claude Monet, all made at an age when most people might think of retiring. Irma Kurtz, the writer, broadcaster and agony aunt, has made it her mission in recent years to address social attitudes to creativity in old age. And she's made a special study of Claude Monet, from whom she thinks we can learn a lot. Leah Caribbean met her in the galleries to find out more.
Irma, we're here in front of Monet's Water Lilies Setting Sun, probably painted in around 1907, when Monet was 67 years old, and maybe only completed when he was in his 80s. And it's a view down onto the surface of his lily pond at his garden in Giverny, and it's an extraordinary picture, isn't it?
It's a wonderful feeling, having stood in this very place, in the garden. This feels like the pond at Giverny. But this is especially interesting because, first, we're lucky to have it. When he grew old, like a lot of old artists, he sometimes changed and even destroyed canvases. And this could well have been one of them in 1907. And so we're very fortunate to be able to see this wonderful, bright, beautiful piece of work.
And you've really been interested in old age as an age where it's a moment where people are in fact actually incredibly inspired and creative. And I wondered what it was that drew you to Monet in particular.
I think I was drawn to Monet partly because he did his arguably best work in his old age. And I would argue that, by the way. I think he did do his best work in his old age. And I also know that he had to overcome terrible things. The death of his second wife stopped him painting for a while. And without the encouragement of people like Clemenceau, who was a great friend of his, he would probably have given up. But he didn't give up. He didn't go gentle. He resisted. He fought. It was hard work, and it is hard work in old age to hang on to your dreams and your vision, because a man who nearly lost his sight in old age, can you imagine what a painter, an artist feels when that gift is threatened? That, and he finally only had the operation a few years before the end, and it was successful.
Yes, thank goodness.
Thank goodness it was successful.
And it's thought that it was after the operation that he actually put the final touches on this picture, including that wonderful bright red signature
exactly.
In the corner.
Because, in fact, the condition of his eyes made red and black problematical in his work previously. So he actually had something in old age that he had lacked for a long time before.
And do you think that it's actually the fact that he had to deal with things like cataracts, he had to deal with bereavements, he was dealing with, in fact, the whole gamut of things that happen in old age, do you think that actually prompted this great flowering, really, of creativity at the end of his life?
Flowering is the perfect word, because, of course, the water lilies are a wonderful example of that flowering, aren't they? He coped with a great many things, too. Don't forget that there was a war in 1914, and the smoke from the war nearby was drifting over his head in the garden. You know, so it was not just his personal life that he had to struggle again, resist giving in, and I think he should be very proud. I'm very proud.
That's good that you're proud. But I mean, older creatives, what's our recipe? What do we need to be holding on to, do you think?
For one thing, friends. because he had good friends who helped him a lot through the crises, and helpers, even paid helpers. He paid a young man, you know, to go out in a little boat and clean the leaves of the water lilies before he painted them. It isn't a bad idea to have a support team in place.
So support and determination.
And determination, and of course, genius helps.
Thank you so much.
Not at all.
Our thanks to Irma Kurtz. Water Lilies, Setting Sun is on display in Room 43. One Friday last month, we held a special event to coincide with our major exhibition, Leonardo da Vinci, Painter at the Court of Milan. Hosted by writer and broadcaster Robert Warby, it explored Leonardo's fascination with music and featured a performance of songs and musical pieces from the artist's time. Among the topics for discussion was a portrait by Leonardo called The Musician, which shows a beautiful young man holding a scrap of music. Robert Warby asked his guest, musicologist Dr. Tim Shepherd, what he made of the work.
It's a very interesting painting. This was a particularly interesting time for portraiture. Portraiture was undergoing a bit of a mini-revolution. Earlier 15th century portraits tend to focus absolutely on a profile, so that you see the sitter like this. But towards the end of the 15th century, the sitter sort of moves sort of towards you. He sort of wants to look at you, but he doesn't quite. Now, that completely changes the way in which a portrait can be used, what it's for, what it can say. In particular, it can start to encode more of a personality, and that's what a lot of people think of with Leonardo's portraits. Now, here we've got rather a strange attitude in the sitter. He's showing us his piece of paper, which has a little bit of music on, but he's not looking at us. Who is he showing the paper to? Who is he looking at? Now, the music is slightly decipherable. It was actually overpainted for a lot of this painting's life. Someone painted over the top of it, and then it was discovered when the painting was cleaned. Now, that means that probably a lot of the detail from that patch has been lost. So it may be that, I mean, you can see how much there is left of the music, really just snippets. But what there is very precisely painted. So it seems like maybe Leonardo intended for us to see all of the notes and to maybe be able to recognise it, or at least recognise what kind of music it's supposed to be. As it is, we've got very little to go on. You can see that we've got a line of recognisable notes at the bottom, and just above them is some text, which suggests to me that maybe it's a song, and the text should go with whatever notes were on the line above it. However, what kind of song, we really don't know.
Maybe, Liam, you could play that for us. I noticed there are two symbols that look like modern-day sharp signs or natural signs.
It's a clef telling you where C is.
So it's to do with the musical intervals.
Yeah. So there are two possible resolutions of it, depending on where that clef goes. And I can play them both for you.
Yeah, that would be... That would be good. Tim, can we just go back to the painting so we can see the music? It strikes me that the music, two things, it's folded, mm-hmm. So and it's also facing out to us.
Yeah.
The musician is not looking at the music. We can see the music. And also, it's mentioned often that the sitter's eyes, there are tears just in the bottom of his eyes, and his lips are just parted.
What strikes me is all the verse that was popular at the courts at this time, and particularly the poetry that was sung, is about adopting the position of the unsuccessful lover. every courtier yearned to be spurned by a beautiful lady, and which, of course, would give them occasion to complain about it at great length in song. It strikes me that perhaps that's the scenario that Leonardo is trying to give us in this picture. Maybe the song that's being shown to us expresses the grief in love that this courtly gentleman is feeling and experiencing. But of course, actually, it's one of the features of this kind of poetry that even though the poet is saying or singing his words, what he says is, "Oh, my grief in love has made me silent. My voice stills in my chest." And so he goes on and on about having a broken voice, which is a little bit of a contradiction in terms. Whereas here, actually, he is apparently silent. His weeping has brought his song to an end, so he can only show us the score, so that we can understand the sensations that he is experiencing. However, sadly, we can't, because someone painted over it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thanks to Tim Shepherd, Robert Warby, and the performers, Liam Byrne, Matthew Long, and Arngeir Hauksson. That's nearly it for this episode, but just before we finish, some news for listeners living near Liverpool, Norwich or Cardiff. Titian's masterpiece, Diana and Actaeon, will be on tour for the next few months, visiting each of those cities in turn. If you'd like to catch it near you, see the website for details. That's www.nationalgallery.org.uk. Until next time, goodbye.